Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Vagabonds, Tourists in the Heart of Darkness, by Nick Brockhausen and Jeff Miller. Narrated by Andrew B. Whirlin. The wind whispers in my ears, and the moonlight lights my way. My past is behind me, abed and tucked away with my fears. The rails will carry me to tomorrow and whatever might lay. Vagabond, vagabond, follow your heart till the end of your years. Nick Brockhausen. Chapter 1. Birth of a Notion. In our journey through this life, we are faced with choices and situations which array themselves against the backdrop of consequence and the bizarre. Our fate plays itself out while we, impressed with our ability to accomplish our dreams, stumble forward like some Pavlovian experiment, stoically taking our wounds and suffering as fair for the trip. Once one has survived the ultimate contest between skill, luck, and happenstance, which defines combat, everything else seems easy and within reach. In my military career, I had participated in some of the most dangerous and daring operations the United States had undertaken as a nation. During that time, I met some of the most incredible and intelligent people who encouraged me in my madness and tutored me in the skills to survive and prosper in my endeavors. This is the beginning of my life journey, and that of my closest comrades after we left the womb of the military. It shall be their story, for they deserve the recognition, good or bad. I am swimming up from the depths of a catatonic sleep, still in that netherland of some feverish dream. I crack one eye open and try and focus on my surroundings. I am on a journey of awakening, but the way my head feels, I may have premature expectations. I manage to get both eyes open and adjust to the dim light. I hear a chirping sound off to one side, and as I move my head to better focus on the source, the first thing that looms into view is a large male raccoon who is busy chewing on what appears to be a half-eaten slice of pizza. I still think I am in the clutches of the dream state. I lay there like a Chiari victim, paralyzed and unable to do anything more than drool. My God, this thing is huge. It must weigh 40 pounds and has that sleek look of the urban garbage can aficionado. It keeps staring at me as it chews the pizza and makes little chirping noises as if we were breakfast chums. I am feeling around as I try to get some distance from it, and my hand grasps what is most assuredly a pistol. It's tangled up in the covers and sheets, which are trapping me as well. I'm effectively trussed up like a Thanksgiving turkey ready for the oven. I keep trying to free the pistol and get it up in case this apparition from the Bullwinkle show shows any signs of being hostile. I am surveying my surroundings at the same time, since I can't remember where I am. How did I get here? And which of my friends were involved? At least they left me a gun. I get the gun free. Ah, it's a Browning High Power, and it's mine. I start looking for my clothes as I manage to get to the head of the bed without being swarmed by my breakfast date. I am slowly getting up as I spy my discarded clothing. I move over and start pulling together the appropriate rumpled ensemble, all the while making soothing noises to the furball with his pizza box cuisine. He has finished the contents, and now he's beginning to chew the cardboard. Lovely. I am beginning to recognize my where. It's the spare bedroom of Jay's humble abode in Ayer, with the decor of a military surplus warehouse crossed with a speed shop. I also remember the raccoon's name. It's Rocky. And Rocky has now decided that I might know additional food sources and follows me out of the bedroom and down the hall to the kitchen. I remember now how I got here. I had just processed out of the army, with my illusions shattered and a bad taste in my mouth for the future. My last gasp at trying to reconcile 17-plus years in special forces had been the Iranian mess. Charlie had spun up the newly minted Delta Force, which was brimming with former Sante raiders, and had trundled it forth to stab the Ayatollah minions in the heart. A lightning-fast strike force with overwhelming fire support, with thousands of moving parts, had been cobbled together. It was a good plan, and only had one fatal flaw. The umbilical cord stretched all the way back to the White House, and the go, no-go button was in the hands of the Georgia mafia surrounding the president. The ground commander had no latitude to adjust, adapt, or do anything other than answer the satellite phone. Throw together an amazing chain of events that unfolded on Desert One, and the whole thing disintegrated. The subsequent second attempt and the political roller coaster surrounding it had convinced me that there was no adult supervision higher than the group level. I was thoroughly disgusted with the Army and the government in general. My disillusion was to the point that I needed to reinvent myself. Thus, here I was out of the service and looking at my prospects. Rhodesia and the African market for my skill sets were winding down, and the banana wars had just begun to spin up. I was tooling an idea over with two other special forces types who were getting out. We were all in Massachusetts, where we had served together in the 10th Special Forces Group. Jeff Miller is a gifted, if not totally twisted, fellow traveler. I suspect that he, like Doberman Pinschers, has trouble with his brain not fitting in his slower-growing skull. Jeff is short, compact, and a direct descendant of the Miller clan who rode with Frank and Jesse. In fact, his great-granduncle Clell was gunned down on the streets of Northfield. I had found an old picture taken after his esteemed and newly deceased uncle had been put on display in front of the general store. Draw in a pair of military glasses, and zip, perfect resemblance. Jeff wears correctional glasses, and they make him look and see better. Without them, he resembles a cross-eyed Wolverine. Penguini, the third part of the Troika, and I had been in Berlin together. He was retiring out as a master sergeant, whereas Miller and I had pulled the cord short of 20 years. Penguini is an extremely talented martial artist. In fact, his brother was one of the Memphis Mafia around Elvis Presley. He and Red and Sonny West were the inner core around Elvis. His brother, who we and others refer to as the Grand Master, or just the GM, is tall, imposing, and deadly. Whereas Penguini is compact, jovial, and deceptively harmless-looking. His nickname of Penguini is based upon a notorious picture that found its way onto the wall of many a guesthouse and bar in Berlin. We had shared adventures, scrapes, and advanced fibbing, as well as a couple of women during our time in Berlin. I knew him as well as I knew my dark side. The three of us have decided to put together a training company, which we will use to teach SWAT teams and other interested parties the fine art of counterterrorism, while attempting to possibly insinuate ourselves into some of the darker corners of our government. Mind you, this is before the tsunami of private security and military contract groups that would emerge 20 years later. In that time, private security was dominated by Wackenut and Kroll Associates. The elite of the elite in the security industry were former FBI, with a mixture of flotsam and jetsam from the alphabet soup crowd dominating the upper echelons. We were aiming at a narrow slice of that pie. Little did we know that the lack of even basic business skills would flame out our ambitions later. As it was, we were ready to take on the world of high-speed action, using our skills and knowledge. We had our first customer in the form of the International Association of Chiefs of Police to deliver SWAT seminars to selected customers drawn from all over the U.S. and the world. These would be three-day seminars in locations around the U.S. Chief Quinn from Newton had been a sponsor of our absorption into respectability and eventually led to our association with Frank Bellotti, the Attorney General of Massachusetts. Frank was a UDT veteran from the Korean War and kept a beer tap at his desk. He was also the most powerful AG in the country. This man was assisting in finding us work and keeping a watchful eye that we didn't surrender to the dark side. Penguini and I had been using alternative housing since our budget was in the red. We had commandeered a demo well in a bridge abutment, which we tricked out with cast-offs like a couch, rug, bunks, and a hot plate, then pulled power from the building next door with a long patched-together extension line. It was a state building, so we surmised the load loss would go unnoticed. We came home one day to find the AG and his imposing chief of detectives sitting on our couch, drinking our beer, and noting the number of felonies attached to our choice of abode. Our next domicile, after Frank found out about our fortress of solitude, was the chief of detectives' empty house in Dedham. Great place, but no heat in February, which made hygiene and exercise and standing in a tin tub, then pouring hot water from a pot heated on the kitchen range. Then, soaping quickly, whilst having the other guy hold a gun on you to encourage you to pour a pot of cold for the rinse. After a couple of months, we finally secured a flat across the commons from the state house and actually were anticipating living like normal people. We had come up to Ayer for a real hot shower and alcohol before we could move in. I'm starting to recover some of the events from the night before, and they're not pretty. We had been club crawling in Leominster and Ayr. We had gathered old acquaintances as the night wore on. By midnight, our prospects for attracting the opposite sex had dwindled to the desperate. So we had finished up the night at Jay Hill's side mansion for the heathens. I remember this as the raccoon waddles into the kitchen. I am busy trying to coax some coffee out of the Mr. Coffee by adding water to the tar-like remnants, then heating it. Rocky squats on his hind legs and pushes his hands forward in supplication, all the while chirping some coon dialogue at me. I hate this raccoon and its owner. They are a visual reminder that the original idea of seeking change had been to progress, not regress. I am still not quite sure what the real world will offer. So far, if the last few weeks had been a harbinger, it has been like a military field trip on acid. We are the eternal optimists. No matter the obstacle, we can adapt and overcome. Except for Pinguini, that is, who is convinced he is dying of something and is running around with eye color charts to read liver health and getting high colonic enemas to detoxify. Knowing his past, he will need to change the mixture to quicklime and sulfuric acid. I hear stirrings from some of the scattered bodies lying around on couches, corners, and one in the bathtub. All fine examples of rough men standing ready to visit violence on our enemies. Rough as a descriptor being the prime word. It's Sunday, and this place reeks. Meanwhile, the raccoon is licking someone's face, waking him to a shrieking reality. I'm thinking that Sunday is off to a fine start, with religious services being optional. Most of the survivors are looking for a cold beer. The refrigerator has already been looted, and someone else remembered a stash in a cooler outside. The coffee is pure caffeine and tastes like asphalt, but I am awake. The phone rings and I pick it up. It's Miller, and he is on his way over here to link up for breakfast. He has the details on our first contract. I am great with that idea. With this masked night denizen finishing off any scraps left over from last night and the fridge robbed, like the 310 to Yuma, eating out is haute cuisine. I make my way to the door, running into Jay on the way. That boy has so much body hair that he looks like a bigger version of his little pal Rocky. The raccoon has better breath, though. He burps a query of where I'm going, so I tell him someone puked in the John, and I'm going to use a tree. As I clear the house, I see him peeking at me out the veranda. He suspects that I am going after food, and since I know his spending habits, if it is after the 10th of the month, he is broke. He's looking for someone generous, and it's not me. I walk out to the driveway as Miller pulls into the entrance. He has the Pinguini with him. I slide into the car and we make off for Denny's. Perfect for this morning. A good, wholesome breakfast with a gallon of coffee. Loud enough that people don't eavesdrop easily, and not yet full of the party survivors from last night. Miller is excited, which means that there is a hint of money in the air. The Pinguini is equally excited. He has a nose for money, especially if he gets some of it. Jeff is his usual laid-back self, but pensively a twitter with the plan. He has been romancing the IACP through his contact with a large security firm. He has been conventioning with that crowd, and has somehow talked them into giving us the contract to present all their SWAT seminars. The students will come from departments all over the U.S. and internationally. I'm starving, So I'm only getting half of his debrief as he wings his way through traffic like he has a full cruiser with the lights on. Guaranteed a number of classes, multiple cities, travel expenses in the budget, and we get to flog a couple of our own products. Sounds great. Much too perfect. I am sure there is a hook in there somewhere. The money is barely enough to keep heart and soul together, but it will lead to other things. So we bite, and bite hard. Our real interest is selling our design for an armored shield that can be used for a variety of situations where you don't want to be the bleeder. Jeff is the perfect obtuse for our troika. He has the smarts, the photogenic face for the front, and he has a snappy dresser. Sort of a Hannibal Smith, cloned with face and Murdoch. A hybrid, if your taste runs to waters dark and deep. He also has the memory of a mainframe and visual accents like cufflinks. Additionally, he is far calmer than Pinguini and myself. I know from past experience that Pinguini will always have a pre-planned escape route. So I stay close to him and act as interpreter between him and the brain. Taken together, we might pass as a whole human. We are to present our first set of the program next week in Newton. Chief Quinn has cobbled together principal players in this newfangled SWAT concept. We know a good number of them and have worked with them in the past. Most are the cookie-cutter copy of Beat Cops and are most decidedly Irish. These are third and fourth generation cop families, churning out generations of the Thin Blue Line. It's almost poetic until you drink with them. We are acceptable since we are a similar gene pool. We arrive at the Denny's and soon are happily awaiting the feast, going over the minutiae and structuring the seminar, breaking down the instructional content. I hear more people coming in behind us and ignored at first. Then I hear the distinctive chirping of that forest rat behind me. I turn, and there is Rocky squatting on the floor with his two little hands outstretched again in supplication. He is on a dog leash, and at the other end is his owner, the ogre. Jay doesn't miss a beat. He slides in next to me and asks if we have already ordered. I know this drill. He will order when the waitress comes back, and she will assume we are all on the same bill. Rocky has climbed up in his lap and is having a grab fest at anything loose on the table. The waitress arrives and immediately tells Jay that dogs, cats, hobos, and critters are not allowed. Jay demands to see the manager. The manager comes out and tells him to take his critter outside. There is a spirited conversation about rights, animal rights, health codes, etc., but the manager is unmoved by the schmooze. Jay gets up, exits the cafe with his fur-covered pal, and walks over to his Cadillac. We can see the whole event transpire. He can't let Rocky in the car because the little beastie will have chewed the interior into scrap by the time breakfast is over. So he grabs him and walks over to the trunk and jams him in with the spare tire and car parts. He is soon back with us and inevitably gets wind of our little enterprise. Jeff has already filled out the instructor list, and we placate Jay with promises of including him in some future event.
Jeff has, though, added one person who is not prior military.
This is in the form of Max. Max was a cast-off from the agency. Yes, that one. He has been an advisor to the Mujahideen in their fight against the Soviet Union. He had been terribly efficient and had taken to the locals and culture with a vengeance. Unfortunately for the Langley crowd, he had gone native. When they sent the stand-down order, he went back into the hills with his adopted brethren. They had eventually managed to pull him out of the Hindu Kush and back to Washington for reassignment. He did some work in Washington for a while, which consisted mainly of taking Arab officers to the various strip joints and occasionally, surreptitiously, filming their liaisons for future use as a lever. He got his nickname because he looks exactly like Max Headroom on MTV. Max is looking for extra income because his latest girlfriend chucked him out on the streets. We're going to meet him and go over the tasks. He hasn't had formal instruction in class presentation or content, but we assume that if the agency hired you, it stands to reason that you have some skill sets. Our assumption will prove to be fragile at best. We get up to go, and of course, Jay has to go and check on Rocky before the check arrives. You're dividing up the bill when I see him flip open the trunk lid.
He stands there with a few food scraps that he had filched from the table, looking down and talking to his little pal.
We can't see the raccoon, but evidently confinement doesn't agree with him, as he launches himself and lands on Jay's chest and claws his way up to his shoulder, administering some bite complaints along the way. Jay goes berserk and flails around the back of the caddy with his self-animated raccoon stole. He finally wrestles him into the car and tight reins him, then squeals off. Miller, a.k.a. the Beast, has fallen into the role of the A-Team's Hannibal Smith, and within the next week we have assembled our group and are ready to do our first seminar. We have all rehearsed our classes in front of the others. All that is except Max. He was in Washington, burdened with some important task that his masters tapped him for at the last minute. After being fully versed in his past history, I am sure that this is not the truth. For whomever his managers are, they avoid him like the career-wrecking adrenaline junkie that he is. The day of the seminar, we are primed and ready to go, and Max is a no-show. We are awaiting his arrival and plotting what to do with the body if and when he does show, when we get a call from the airport in Boston. His plane was late. He forgot his homework. He ran out of gas. All blarney. He more than likely spent the night in his car and overslept. Chief Quinn ends up sending a squad of cars to pick him up with sirens and all. He arrives and breezes past us like the rabbit in Alice in Wonderland and begins his presentation. He has crib sheets that he is reading from in the most monotonous, boring drone we've ever heard. Everyone's heads are lolling, and some are asleep in the first 10 minutes. He never looks up and continues his droning monologue. He has eventually run out of crib notes, which were out of order anyway, and has resorted to notes he has written on the palm of one of his ham-like mitts. There seems to be no end to this. Penguini, in desperation, saves the moment by setting fire to the trash can in the rear and allows us to get Max off the podium. He was right in the middle of outlining on whiteboard the proper step-by-step execution of a search pattern, each step represented by some fatiguing dot matrix. We rush him out to the hallway like a bad vaudeville act. Evidently, the farm doesn't process their trainees in any sort of instructional format. Not surprising, since their job is to get someone to betray their country, whilst Special Forces is designed to train, equip, and lead guerrilla forces and develop an underground. This is why the post office in Langley has a paramilitary division, chock full of former SF. Max, unfortunately, was from the deceit and betrayal division. But he is full of interesting information. All we need to do in the future is siphon it out of his brain. Just don't let him present the class. So Max gets a pass on the first one, and we find his niche in our vision. Basically, he is a cataract in the movement, blurred sight. We have begun to design and produce equipment to augment SWAT-type operations. The first and best idea is a design for a ballistic shield with a see-through window and a gun port that resembles a Roman legionary's scuta or shield. We have the basic design and a prototype finished when the Penguini's older brother, the Grand Master, calls and convinces us that there are a ton of opportunities in California for developing our training and equipment market. So we pack up and drive to California in our leased Camaro. California is a culture shock, but in some ways, pleasantly so. We go from surviving to surviving with a purpose, and in nicer weather. We establish a new company and combine it with the GM's Karate Empire, and continue to look forward to the occasional IACP seminar. The time is just before the 84 Olympics, and we have finalized a design and produced 10 such shields in Miller's garage, and eventually in the back of the ammunition reloading business we set up as a sidebar. We have stumbled onto a laminate, and cross-stitching the Kevlar allows us to stop all handguns in both the window and the shield. Because the shield is shaped with a soft anodized face, when bullets strike it, the force is distributed down rather than back. We get an invite to display and demonstrate the shield at the San Diego Police Academy, a training area they call Duffy Town. We have shot 3 shields to near destruction with no penetration, so Jeff takes the shield downrange with the instructions to range control that he is going to lash it to a pole. I am back at the table with a variety of handguns and submachine guns ready to go. As he passes me, he tells me, "I'm going to get down behind this, and when I give you the signal, fire as many shots as you can get off before they shut you down." Why not? What could go wrong? I catch the Penguini after overhearing his instructions. sidling towards an escape route as Jeff gets set and finally gives me the hand signal after crouching behind the shield so he doesn't get hit in the shin by a stray round if they wrestle the gun from me. I pick up a submachine gun and empty the magazine and manage to get a few shots off with a .44 Magnum, all while range control is screaming, "Ceasefire!" The guns and I are semi-violently separated by range control's safety goons. The beast stands up and invites the attendees to view the back of the shield and himself. "Anyone wants to come and take a look? No holes in it. No holes in me." The rangemaster is incensed, but the cops like it. We stand behind our products, literally. This is not a marketing method I recommend, but it works. The approaching Olympics triggers a buying spree, and we quickly run through our inventory. We are a contender under our name of Rhino Armor, so we print up glossies and start the convention circuit. This depletes our cash on hand, and it seems to be a never-ending cycle of feast or famine. In the middle of this scramble, Jeff finds out he has Meniere's disease, which has him occasionally writhing on the floor with vertigo and projectile vomiting. This can be entertaining, but complicating. I am at the ammunition factory one afternoon when he says he needs to lie down. He goes outside, gets in his car, and naps out. 30 minutes later, the cops show up on a complaint that a drunk is lying half out of a car in the parking lot. Sure enough, it's the beast. He is flopping around weakly and has spattered heave ammo all over the car, himself and the parking lot. Now, any suggestion of caffeine and he goes into spasms. 2 weeks after the parking lot incident, we are in my new Jeep Cherokee returning from L.A. He has an attack and is trying to get the window open while I am threatening his demise if he chucks up in the car. We get off the freeway, and as we are going down the ramp, a Porsche with a sunroof passes us on the right and stops next to us at the light. It's some L.A. type, with the coiffed hair and open shirt with gold neck chain and Serengeti glasses, next to his equally glamorous blonde bimbo. They both are smirking at the beast, who looks weakly at them, making moaning sounds. The guy throws some snotty remark, and Jeff obliges him with everything in his digestive tract, right through the sunroof. Lovely. Our lifestyle and the business we are in lend themselves to meeting interesting people in all walks of life. These range from the fantastic to the law-abiding, with stops along the way for the odd criminal or unsavory specimen. R.O. is one such personage. He is in the ammo business and is a gun nut and patriot, supporter of anything using selective force. He's a 250-pound bubba, with one of those falsetto voices usually heard down south. Speaks Spanish and knows every cop between here and the moon. He's an ex-pro football player and moves with astonishing grace. He can also teach man-tracking since he is an avid bow hunter. So we decide to add tracking to the seminar syllabus and take him along to our second seminar in Montgomery County, Maryland. They have a big complex with buildings for the fire academy, road track, classrooms, and an underground Murfreestown. We are set for a day of training in rappelling and are set up on the fourth story of one of the fire buildings. R.O. is running the rappelling station. I am helping out. We've also brought Jay with us, sans his little buddy Rocky. He has driven his camper down here with all the equipment. I had ridden with him. It would be a marvelous trip if you like speeding and controlled mayhem. He has the RV parked in the lot below and had retired to his cave about an hour prior. He had no more classes, and soon we can hear Merle Haggard yodeling his way through the thin walls of the RV. R.O. says that we need to set up an additional station, so I turn to one of the students. This group was ostensibly from the State Bureau of Investigation, read FBI being undercover from the locals. Nice group, well-mannered, obvious newbies getting some extra training. I tell him to go down to the RV and have Jay give him ropes, snap links, cable, etc. He takes off and I return my attention to R.O. The kid comes back in record time sans equipment. I ask him where the ropes are, and he gives me a nervous look and suggests I go check myself. Jay has medical issues and carries enough pharmaceuticals to start his own Walgreens. He has nitro tabs for his heart and amyl nitrate snappers in case he needs a quick boost. All this is rolling through my head as I go down the stairs. The closer I get to the RV, the louder the music is. He has changed to Charlie Pride, but it's at agony level. I sweep the door open, and the overwhelming smell akin to that of old sweat socks wafts past me. Jay is standing in the middle of the room with a half bottle of Jack Daniels, dressed in...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?